You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're continuing my conversation with Martin Kuz, a Sacramento-based journalist who spent the past year traveling to Ukraine to understand the toll of the Russian invasion on everyday Ukrainian lives. Martin just returned from his third reporting trip in the past 12 months. We sat down on Friday, the 1 year marking the start of the war. When you mention, you know, kind of the last 12 months, and I look at the reporting that you've shared through your reporting in Sacktown Magazine and then also the Christian Science Monitor, but also on Twitter and on Facebook, you chronicle these daily lives and you capture these incredibly personal stories of Ukrainians. How did you meet each person that you profiled and really get them to open up and share intimate devastation and loss?
Great credit goes to translators with whom I've worked, who have helped me better understand where to find the stories to share with readers. I do as much planning as I can before I go over and identify areas that I'm interested in visiting, but I rely very much on my translators to help me connect with Ukrainians who are living their lives, and I'm visiting from abroad, and I show up and I start asking questions. And what I have found by and large is that Ukrainians want their story to be told, no matter how deep their suffering or how great their loss. They seem to have an understanding that to remain silent allows Russia to continue operating with impunity. And I think they don't want people to forget around the world what they're going through. And so when I visit a village like Kamianka, about 80 miles from Kharkiv, near the city of Izum, another town that experienced horrible atrocities when Russians occupied the area early in the war, Kamianka is a village of about 1,000 residents. Every single home is damaged or destroyed. It is considered a 100% loss. And yet there are still about 30 to 40 residents living in the area. And I met one man, Vasily, who was thrice victimized by the Russians, suffered a shrapnel wound from artillery when his house was hit, later was hit in the head with a Kalashnikov by a drunk Russian soldier during the occupation. And then after Ukrainians had liberated Kamianka, Vasily, who is a farmer, was out clearing his fields of the war debris that the Russians had left behind, ammo boxes, there was incinerated tanks, and he was simply trying to prepare his fields once again for planting and harvesting, and he stepped on a landmine and lost his left foot. And Vasily, in many ways, embodies the Ukrainian spirit. Here is a man who has lost so much, and he doesn't wallow in self-pity. What saddens him is the suffering of his fellow Ukrainians. The only time that he broke down during our conversation was when he was recalling the destruction of neighbors' homes, the screams of farm animals ripped open by artillery, the death of one neighbor, a man who was left lying in his yard for weeks by the Russians. He doesn't express any sorrow for himself. He's talking about resuming his farming as best he can while on crutches, waiting for a prosthetic foot. And meeting people like that, their willingness to share these intimate, devastating stories with me, it feels then like a kind of duty to bring those stories to a wider audience. And it's, again, thanks to the translators in Ukraine who also approach their work with a degree of sensitivity that can't be understated, because they too, of course, are suffering. Every translator with whom I've worked has been separated from family. Some of their parents have had to evacuate. Childhood homes have been destroyed. So for them, it isn't simply a job. They're also trying to share this narrative of Ukraine under siege with the wider world.
You also shared another story of a mother and her daughter, Victoria and Olena. You spoke with Olena because Victoria was killed. They lived a mile from each other and would walk to each other's homes on a regular basis. And Victoria didn't show up one day and they would eventually, what you describe, they found her body in a crude grave marked with wooden crosses with the number 76 next to it. What did Olena teach you about that loss, losing her daughter at 52 years old? Her daughter was 52.
Olena spoke with such eloquence about her daughter and about the bond that they shared. And in one great respect, what she taught me was less what she actually said than the fact that she continued talking to me through her tears. She almost never stopped crying as we had our discussion, which probably lasted 45 minutes. So the pain is right there before you, and yet she wants to tell the story of Victoria. And there is so much in that. There is the warmth of a mother, pain of a mother, but it also summarizes the suffering of a nation. And this goes back to that idea that every Ukrainian has felt loss to one degree or another. And what I learned from Olena, who grew up in the Soviet era, who understands Russian oppression going back decades, is the need for Ukraine to stand free and independent of Russian oppression. She has paid a grave price as a Ukrainian, and the Ukrainian people have done nothing more than simply try to live free, and for that they're paying the ultimate price. And Olena, she's not about to submit to Putin, to the Russian regime. In fact, she's ever more defiant. And so beneath all of that pain is this resolve of steel that you can kill us, you can physically remove people from our lives, but you cannot douse the Ukrainian spirit. And it wasn't her pronouncing that in grand terms. It is in that understated way of sharing her loss, but also with that determination that she will go on and that her people will go on. So you see in those discussions the personal dimension of what Ukrainians are enduring. But if you take a step back, you can also see some of those larger themes.
Yeah. What struck me was the people that you spoke with, they're all older. You know, Vasily is 65, Olena is older, and you spoke with Maria, who's 80 years old, and you touch upon this reality that they really have lived this trajectory of what it is to be Ukrainian, even before it was a country, when it was part of the Soviet Union. When learning about Maria, who, when reading from your reporting, she lives in her summer kitchen after a rocket hit and destroyed her home, does she have that same fierce stubbornness, and understandably so, of staying in her home even when it doesn't even exist anymore?
Absolutely. One aspect of her story that I didn't share is that she has a son who is married, and they lived with Maria in Petropavlivka, which at the moment is experiencing kind of horrific shelling. We spoke as these enormous booms surrounded us. And Maria has, at this point, sadly, adapted to this terrible circumstance. Where she is so defiant, she has a son who actually left for Russia with his wife. They came to her after Maria's house had been destroyed by an artillery shell and simply said to her, "We're leaving. You can come with us or you can stay." And Maria said, "I'm not leaving." And you see in that decision not only the reality of a woman who is 80 years old and for whom making that kind of transition would be difficult. It is because she's Ukrainian. She refuses to set foot in Russia again. She has cut off contact not only with her son, but with other relatives and friends who are in Russia, who continue to deny that the war is something that Russia has perpetrated upon the Ukrainian people. There is a closed media ecosystem in Russia, and that propaganda is virulent and sort of comprehensive. And so a lot of Russian people have no idea that this is Putin's war of aggression. And so when Maria tries to educate, or had tried to educate people in Russia that she knew, she realized they believed the lie. And
not her lived experience, what she's experiencing.
It's all fake news, and from the perspective of Russian people. And it's extraordinary as a journalist to spend time with someone who has lost her home, in effect lost her son and daughter-in-law, and to think there are people, in effect millions of people around the world, who don't believe the truth of what Maria is going through every day. I asked her, you have this artillery going off around you all day long, every day. How do you sleep? And she said, you get used to it. With no fanfare, with no kind of ostentatiousness, she simply is saying, I will go on. And I find that to be inspiring. And I find it incredible in that, here in America, it's not to suggest for a moment that everyone's life is easy or simple. But when you consider people getting frustrated about their Starbucks order being mixed up, and then you see this woman who's living in her summer kitchen, which is a room about the size of a walk-in closet. She has a bed, a couple of chairs, and a wood stove. And she's not about to give in to Russia, an 80-year-old grandmother. And that, I think, is sort of exemplifies that strong Ukrainian spirit and that resolve to live free.
Maria captures a reality for a lot of Ukrainians, and that's the fracturing of families, because of misinformation and disinformation. Did you get a sense collectively of the national mood, the morale, as this war enters its second year with really no signs of it ending anytime soon?
The people that I've met throughout the past year have almost to a person suffered a kind of loss. In some cases, it has been obvious. They have lost a loved one, perhaps someone who is serving in the Ukrainian military or with the Territorial Defense Force, a volunteer force. In many cases, however, it's more subtle. It's simply this breach that has been created by this war. Ukrainians and Russians weren't by any means one people, as Putin described them a summer before he launched his invasion. But there was a kinship, without question, and a shared history. Now there is a demarcation, and there is a feeling that Ukraine gained its independence in 1991 after the Soviet Union broke apart. But as one person said to me, we knew even then that we would likely have to face Russia in war, that there would have to be blood before we fully claimed our independence. And so much blood has been shed in the past year, and it hasn't for, I think, a moment and for a person dimmed the resolve of Ukrainians to continue fighting. Is there a weariness? Without question. There is extreme deprivation, but there is not a sense of capitulation. I think that perhaps the greatest miscalculation of this entire war is Putin's belief that Ukrainians would welcome the Russian invaders, that they would, quote, feel liberated, quite the opposite. And that underlies all the suffering, all the destruction, all the loss. Underneath all of that, or perhaps above all of that, is this understanding that Ukraine will not acquiesce. And I don't think that has changed from a year ago. In fact, I would argue that it has actually been fortified by military gains, but also by the fact that a year later, Ukraine is still standing, is standing proud. And now the world knows Ukraine. that was something that frustrated my father for many years, was this sense that people thought of Ukraine as just part of the Soviet Union, not as an independent nation. Now the world knows, for the worst reason possible, but the world knows, and I think moving forward, Ukraine, even in the midst of war, can see a different kind of future for itself. And it, I think, is that glimmer of hope that helps sort of fortify their resolve.
I think it's also important to note that given you're a freelance and independent journalist, covering a war on your own is not only comes with dangers, it's also expensive. And this wouldn't have been possible without the support of people donating to make this possible. I was looking at your GoFundMe and you had a goal of like $3,000 to cover some of the travel expenses, not all, but the donations surpassed that amount by fivefold, $15,000. What does that mean to you? What does that say to you?
Difficult to find words to express the gratitude. I think it's fair to say I sit before you utterly humbled. I think it reflects two things. One is compassion and concern for Ukrainians, this desire to try to help in whatever way possible. And then I think people understand that there is a connection between sustaining Western support and continuing to tell the story of Ukraine and everyday Ukrainians. To some extent, it might also be a little bit of faith in me and a feeling that I can share those stories, find those stories and share those stories. I was stunned by the response. I had never expected that kind of generosity. What I have found in those exchanges with people who have generously contributed is a kind of empathy that we sometimes lose sight of. Empathy for people on the other side of the world who we likely will never meet, but that we want to somehow help and reach out. We saw this again recently with the earthquakes in Turkey and Syria. There is one important difference, and that is the war, any war, is a man-made disaster. And I think there is this really strong sense that storytelling is essential to kind of displaying the humanity within Ukraine that helps us realize that this isn't simply about tanks and fighter jets and soldiers on the battlefield. This is about average people like you and me trying to survive the day and trying to imagine a future for children and grandchildren. And I think that desire is something that a lot of people actually share, that they want to continue to read these stories. So I am the most surprised at the number of contributions that came in and the amount. And it has made the reporting possible. And it has further deepen this idea for me that the story is so personal. It has only made me more determined to continue telling the story of Ukraine.
You just landed back in the States, but are you already thinking about returning?
I am. I think that probably in April or May is when I'll make my next trip. And the hope then is to stay a little bit longer and again visit areas that I haven't been to before, probably try to get to the South. And just get a sense of what is happening in those areas as they attempt to recover and, again, to try to survive as this war goes on. I would like to think that I could go back in the spring and it would be a story of Ukrainian victory. And while I do think that Ukraine will prevail in the long run, I'm not convinced that it will happen sooner rather than later. So, yes, I think there'll be at least one more trip this year, and perhaps two. And again, that's because of the generosity of people to this GoFundMe campaign.
It just seems like your mind and your heart is still in Ukraine, even though you're back here in Sacramento.
That's an accurate description. It's a sense of living between worlds. And I have always found journalism, as I'm sure you have, to be something that provides a sense of purpose. For me, it is how I try to give back. And with Ukraine, because it's where my father lived and where he lost so much, there has always been a sense of a kind of unresolved debt, something that I think I vaguely was aware of but didn't fully understand. The war has brought that into much sharper focus, and that's, again, the worst reason why there should be a kind of clarity to my thinking. But it has made me determined to devote as much time as I can in whatever time I have left to telling the story of Ukraine, both while it is caught within war and then what Ukraine will look like beyond war. I do think Ukraine will emerge victorious. I think they will live free and independently, but not without terrific cost. And what people maybe sometimes forget is that when the war, quote, ends, it doesn't really end. Not only is there the physical rebuilding of a nation and a sort of reassembling of day-to-day life, but there is the long tail of psychological trauma. And part of the reporting in this on this trip was looking at this idea of historical remembrance, this notion that Ukraine has suffered throughout its history for centuries. And that includes what my father went through during World War II. Sadly, it's something that's going to continue for decades ahead. And I feel it's my duty as a Ukrainian American to continue to share that story and to remind people about Ukraine and Ukrainians and why it matters that a free, independent, sovereign nation was invaded by a hostile force.
Martin, thank you so much.
Thank you, Vicky.
Martin Kuz is a Sacramento-based journalist who spent the past year traveling to Ukraine to understand the toll of the Russian invasion on everyday Ukrainian lives. Still ahead, we'll meet a Black student-centric organization working to uplift youth and help them succeed in California through mentorship and resources for success. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.